Were human beings meant to be in cubicles all day? Nikhil Saval joins us to talk about his new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
And it started to connote a kind of callousness or arbitrariness in the workplace, that people were just being stuffed in these without any sense of whether they were appropriate to what people needed to do.
Just what are parents expected to do today to raise the elusive, happy, and healthy child? Lenore Scanese will be here to talk about her review of two new books, Alfie Kohn's The Myth of the Spoiled Child and Paul Raeburn's Do Fathers Matter?
There's this national desire to whip ourselves with a cat of nine tails about how we have been disappointing our children, stifling them, stunting them, ignoring them, helping them too much.
My colleagues John Williams, Pearl Sagal, and I will talk about what's going on this week in the book business. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Nikhil Saval is the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. He joins us now from Philadelphia. Hi, Nikhil.
Hi.
So this book is kind of a fascinating history, lots of great anecdotes in here for all of us who work in offices. And I guess the burning question in my mind is, does anyone like cubicles?
Yeah, cubicles are interesting because I think they have taken on a connotation that vastly exceeds their actual problems. I mean, they're not necessarily good design, and most of them don't do a lot of the things that they're supposed to do. They're supposed to provide some measure of privacy, but they often just, you know, they let in noise, and they actually can feel kind of flimsy and exposed. And I think that isn't just part of the design. It's sort of part of the changes in the workplace more generally, and the change in the view of the workplace. I mean, the cubicle really took on the connotations it has today, the kind of efficient meanings it has of just dread and the horror of a bad white collar existence in the late 80s and early 90s when, you know, the layoffs became more common in the workplace. Mergers meant that a lot of people were being shifted out of offices into cubicles.
Dilbert,
of course, 1989 is the debut of Dilbert. That came about because the cubicle started to connote insecurity. It started to connote impermanence, and it started to connote a kind of callousness or arbitrariness in the workplace, that people were just being stuffed in these without any sense of whether they were appropriate to what people needed to do.
Right. All you have to do is change a sort of little metal plate on the outside, and it's sort of interchangeable in terms of who's actually sitting in there.
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't feel great. So that's really why I think that's where a lot of the kind of dislike of the cubicle environment comes from.
But what did the cubicle replace? I mean, you have had, you know, the newsroom where we are is obviously long been a very open plan. What's the trajectory here? What did we go from to get to the cubicle? What were we getting away from?
Well, in a way, most offices prior to the cubicle resembled newsrooms. I mean, and I think sort of the classic newsroom, as you see in things like All the President's Men or His Girl Friday or what have you. I mean, you just had desk after desk in the center of an office that was usually the steno pool or the accounting pool. It was where sort of lightly mechanical tasks were done. Very often it was highly gendered. If it was the steno pool, it tended to be all or mostly women, because women were seen by managers, male managers, as being more suited to that kind of work, something that's taken a long time to change and is still being changed. And then, you know, around the corridor, you had the offices for sort of middle managers. And these had light gradations that indicated status. You would either have a slightly larger office with a couch, or your desk would be made of oak instead of steel, or mahogany instead of oak. I mean, these were the kinds of ways that you symbolize status and prestige in the office. In a way, the original office very much more clearly exuded hierarchy. You could really tell where you were sitting, showed where you were on the office ladder.
Although I wonder if the current formulation of so many offices, which is to say sort of cubicles or open desk plan for the many, with offices reserved really only for the tippy top, in a way, exacerbates hierarchy more than the earlier configurations where you would have a little bit more actual offices for middle management, even if they didn't face windows or they were small.
In a way, there's a kind of polarization or more intense stratification going on. I mean, even in sort of the most supposedly progressive offices, you have the open plan has kind of come back with a vengeance, and the idea is that nobody has an office. You could be the CEO and you have a desk in the middle of the room just like everyone else. I mean, Mike Bloomberg's office famously, and when he was mayor, was like this. He was just in a cubicle like everyone else. And the odd thing is hierarchy, of course, still persists in subtle ways. I mean, you can be in a desk like everyone else, but you still are the CEO maybe, or the mayor, and you are often not forced to sit there.
Right.
You don't have to
sit in that cubicle all day.
Yeah. The relationship between office design and hierarchy and power is complicated. It's not always one-to-one. And just changing the design very often doesn't change the structure of power.
You talk a lot about the relationship between technology and office design. I think about this in terms of open desk plans and cubicles, because they really, in their way, discourage the use of telephones. They discourage the use of face-to-face. What were the designers of those formats thinking in terms of technology, beginning with the telephone? How does that form work with those technologies?
The introduction of the telephone into the office initially had the effect of changing what was largely, this was in the early 20th century, it became more common that it had the effect of changing the face-to-face nature of office interaction. You suddenly didn't have to have offices so close to factories, so you could really conglomerate office functions, mm-hmm. like collar work in downtowns and things like that, and have factories off-site or in outskirts or even what were the early suburbs. But mainly, I mean, office technology started to accelerate so much by mid-century with early computerization, automation of certain tasks, that the designers of the furniture and the systems in some ways had to anticipate that things were going to change rapidly in ways that they didn't quite understand. So the inventor of the office cubicle, Robert Probst, one of the reasons the cubicle is so anodyne, or maybe antiseptic is the word, just so bland, is that he wanted design to be what he called forgivable, that he knew technology was going to change things in the office in ways he couldn't quite anticipate. And so the best thing to do was to make the office as flexible and as kind of undesigned as possible. This results, of course, in some of the blandest environments that anyone has ever had to work in. But one thing that Probst didn't anticipate necessarily is that he was very much interested in movement, and most office designers were interested in having people sort of move around and circulate, most progressive ones. The personal computer, for at least two or three decades, changed that so that you were often stuck at your desk.
Right.
That was one of the things that really made the cubicle kind of not a very great environment, is that you weren't really allowed to move. I mean, the telephone, in a way, does the same thing before it becomes mobile.
Kind of grounds you.
It grounds you, that's right. And so it becomes increasingly hard in these environments to have any kind of private conversation or concentrate in any real sense.
Let's talk about typewriters and what effect that had on sort of office design and culture.
The typewriter can seem initially as a great labor-saving device, but also a kind of leg up for lower middle class, maybe working class, women in particular. The typewriter came in the late 19th century. It was widely adopted by that point. That was the same time that the economy was becoming less agrarian. Women were kind of entering the workforce en masse. And so getting typewriter lessons in the same way that actually women got piano lessons, I mean, it somehow replaced that as a middle class activity. You would learn the typewriter, and that would be your way into a sort of middle-class environment. And the other idea is that it made office work more broadly factory-like. I mean, you could kind of time how quickly you were supposed to type a document. You could obviously type things much more quickly than you could write them out. You had the development of vast typing or steno pools that occupied these cavernous centers of the office. And so people who visited these early offices were suddenly shocked by how what had been a kind of male, small environment had suddenly become large and also largely female and largely more closely resembling the factory than it had before. So the typewriter had sort of mechanized the office or participated in its mechanization.
It's funny how even using the word typewriter these days, for listeners today, it sounds like you're talking about some antiquated 19th century device that, you know, is so remote from our current existence. There was this moment in Mad Men, or sort of this ongoing thread this past season, I don't know if you watch it, where the computer is introduced to the workplace, and it's obviously before the personal computer, but it's seen as this, you know, massive transformation of their physical space. Can you talk a little bit about the first computers and how they changed the design of the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, so the computer was always viewed with a kind of suspicion in white-collar workplaces. I mean, the earliest ones were so enormous. I mean, the ones especially designed by IBM, they were there to automate certain things like accounting functions or payroll. I mean, they couldn't do significantly more than that. The funny thing is that what IBM recognized the kind of threats that people felt about the computer, that they were worried that their jobs were at stake. I mean, not just blue-collar jobs, but certain kinds of white-collar jobs like bookkeeping, things that one feared could be automated. And so they hired a designer, Elliot Noyes. This was part of this broader movement in the culture to design everything and to make machines feel sort of more palatable to human beings. And IBM even went so far as to make a film. They made several films, actually. They hired Charles and Ray Eames, the designers, to make films to show people that the computer was actually going to harmonize and clean up the man's environment. It was leading to a kind of post-industrial age. It's going to enhance human knowledge. It's going to enhance the human capacities. It's not going to replace them. And so even the people who thought that it would replace human beings were wrong. It would kind of lead to this more harmonious workplace. I mean, it wasn't true, and in fact, it did start to automate some jobs, and there was a genuine reason for fear, but there was a big cultural effort to kind of make the computer feel just like an organic part of the environment.
Fast forwarding a few technological iterations to today's computerized office landscape, which is a term that you use. Can you talk a little bit about the rise of office landscapes or office campuses like the Googleplex and sort of how that's changed things?
There are antecedents to those kind of tech campuses, like people might remember or have heard of Bell Labs in New Jersey or Connecticut General, designed by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, an insurance company. They were in the 1950s, they were considered, you know, people were moving out to the suburbs, and it was seen as a way to attract people to kind of pastoral settings. They would have bowling alleys, they would have classes on campus, they would have cafeterias, the idea being that you would be, these places would be sort of self-sufficient. That's, of course, what you see at work in places like Google today. The odd thing, you know, the sort of new thing that they add to that is sort of urbanist design. A lot of these places like Google or Facebook or the advertising agency TBWH Chiat/Day, they're just enormous complexes that have the architects design these sort of streets running through them, and everything you kind of need is there. I mean, you could even get your oil changed at some of these places. You can go to the doctor. You can swim in the resistance pool. And it's meant to kind of be this miniature city. And in a way, it takes functions that cities in some ways already provide and then sequesters them in these spaces, mostly to keep people there.
And if you had to pick between the cubicle, the open desk, the walled-off office, the glass fishbowl office, what do you think is the best environment?
Oh, I think the most private. I mean, I think that's a real crisis that we're facing in the rush to kind of open plan or make things more transparent. Is privacy is what most people need, and most people need to concentrate, and that's what most people like. Those things are being lost
right.
in the current moment.
An increasingly elusive goal. All right, Nikhil Saval, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The book again is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, reviewed in this week's issue of The Book Review. My colleagues John Williams and Pearl Sagal join me right now to talk about the book business and what's going on this week. Hi, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Two controversies, the Goldfinch and the YA debate. Should we start young and get more mature as we go on?
Right. Is the Goldfinch more mature? That's part of the debate.
It's all linked together. Yeah. It'll all end up it's a podcast mashup. Let's start with what's going on in YA. This should have been YA's big week with The Fault in Our Stars opening and doing gangbusters at the box office. But beginning in the week, there was the start of a backlash.
Well, there's a piece on Slate by a journalist named Ruth Graham who wrote a piece that they headlined simply Against YA. And the subheadline generated, I think, even more controversy. It said, read whatever you want, but you should feel embarrassed when what you're reading was written for children. And so this was, in typical Slate fashion, a piece that was sort of designed to get people a little agitated, and it more than succeeded. And on Twitter and other places, people have spent the better part of the week, and it's still continuing, I think, talking about this piece. And obviously the vast majority of respondents were, defending people's right to, A, read whatever they want, and also not to feel embarrassed about it. And also just defending, I think, the best of young adult literature as both worthwhile and also is sometimes hard to distinguish from adult literature.
What did Graham say in her piece?
I think the part of her argument that I sympathize with is that
showing his cards.
I think she's saying a few things, and that people tend to react, strongly, obviously, to the most strongly worded things she said. And I think that she did paint with too broad a brush. But, I think she was addressing the idea that she knows a lot of adults who seem to be reading more young adult books than people did in the past. For instance, the Harry Potter series or John Green.
A lot of those books aren't even YA. They're middle grade.
Yeah, exactly. I'm speaking
more
to
childish,
an expert.
Right?
You should actually define some of these terms because I think that would be useful. And she was, I think, bemoaning the fact that people, as a habit or a trend, read more than they maybe did 20 years ago along those lines.
And it's a zero-sum game.
She made it sound like that, right. Yeah. And I think that was, part of what people were reacting strongly against. And I think she obviously really believes this, but I also think she was trying to be provocative in the way she worded a lot of this. I don't think, I think that there are exceptions that she would probably accept, but I think she went after a group that was ready to defend itself.
That's right. And I think it's become part of this cyclical thing that we're seeing. I mean, this happened with Oprah's book club. This happened with even 50 Shades of Grey, that something becomes popular and we get a think piece like this. It's sort of, there's a lot of anxiety in this piece, right?
Yes.
Like, what is entertainment? What is literature? Who decides? Things are getting worse.
Right.
And then it's going to set off, and then this is going to set off a flurry of pieces that are sort of like in defense of the guilty pleasure. So it's again and again and again, we see this.
Right.
And it's interesting to sort of now, like having seen like, four or five cycles, and then to look at the bestseller list, right? And we have Piketty's book, Capital. We have Knausgard. We have difficult books. It's sort of like
Leslie Jameson's The Empathy
Exam. That's right.
There's like a big seven-figure deal this week
for two new books sold to Little Brown. Yeah. So I think if you've been watching this for a while, you kind of wonder from whence this anxiety. People are still reading a bunch of different kinds of books. Some books are very, very challenging. So
it's interesting that you bring up these other instances, Harry Potter and 50 Shades of Grey, because I think in both of those cases, initially there was this sort of exuberance and excitement that, people are reading and the business is thriving and book sales those years that those books came out went way up. And it was this, okay, we're bringing new people in. And it sort of followed by the necessary kind of self-flagellating, let's find something depressing in this.
That's right.
That's what we do.
That's what we do as readers. The popularity of Knausgard.
It's all a struggle. And note that we are now pronouncing it correctly again after false correction
PSA,
last week.
PSA.
The great controversy, the pronunciation controversy.
It is Knausgard. What was the reaction to Ruth Graham's piece specifically? Where did people write about this and who was writing it and what did they say?
The process of it was really interesting to me because it followed this very increasingly typical response to pieces like this, which was within minutes, there was just a deluge of tweets about it on Twitter. And people were having conversations back and forth. And then within about 24 to 36 hours, a lot of the people who had tweeted had fleshed that out into sort of longer pieces for places like
they got off of Twitter for 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. To write for a New Republic blog or the Hairpin blog and all of these different places. The Atlantic had, I think, more than one piece about it. Mm-hmm. And so
they used to have a column called YA for Grownups or YA for Adults, written by Jen Dahl.
Right. Oh, and Jen Dahl, was the person who wrote on the Hairpin and you know, wrote a strong defense of what she felt were the good qualities of reading YA for adults. And yeah, and so within like 48 hours, you basically had the conversation begun, immediately reacted to, fleshed out, and more or less finished, I thought. Although there's a lot of, if you look it up now on Twitter, there's still a lot of people responding to
it. Did you read people in support of Graham? I read more sort of people like unspooling her argument. I mean, it's also, I think, one of the things about it, about this piece, as you said, she paints with a very broad brush. So she sort of seems, acts as if, or she writes as if people are just reading YA books, the exclusion of other books, you know. So I think people were quick to jump on that point and say, you know.
What I read was mostly negative reaction to it.
Yeah.
And I know that the Times is one of our chief film critics, A.O. Scott, responded on Twitter with a couple of supportive tweets and got pounced on by people for that too. I think that the nature of these pieces is to start arguments and to be very pointed and to paint with a broad brush. Mm-hmm. And the point that she's making, to the degree that it has validity, I think it got lost in the tone a bit, and also in, you know, these debates tend to take on, there's not much subtlety on Twitter. You are either for or against something, and Slate plays into that very often.
Yeah, but I also think that people are sensitive to these sorts of critiques because there's been a lot of shaming around what people read.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can feel to a lot of people very gendered, you know, the shaming of people, chick lit readers or the women who are reading 50 Shades of Grey, you know, and YA readers. I would assume, you know, a large part are women. So I think that this is a group that can feel a little picked on.
It's also a lot about genre because a lot of the popular YA fiction is not only romance, but is high fantasy or dystopic or science fiction. Yeah. And those are genres that can often be seen as lesser.
And there's a really nice conversation about this on the Slate Culture Gabfest podcast, and they talked about
we are not to speak of other podcasts on this podcast, Carl.
But just briefly, this is something I just this once, not even briefly. There's, and I hadn't seen this argument made, and I'm not a huge YA reader, but I like this. And somebody made the point that, you know, what are the narratives in YA, and why do people go to them? And this was something that I, you know, like, let's actually talk about the substance of some of these books. And they talked about, you know, the desire to define yourself, the sort of heroic narratives, those narratives of bravery. And I thought that was lovely. And, like, that's a lovely way to, like, sort of foreground some of these stories as myths.
Yes. I just finished a book, Confession, that is a YA book by Diana Wynne Jones called Fire and Hemlock this week. And there is an essay that accompanies it by the author, the late author, on the heroic ideal, because she wrote this book, which is a fantasy, and incorporates within it two medieval Scottish myths or ballads, Tam Lin and Thomas the Rhymer, as well as the Odyssey, and specifically sets out to create the embodiment of a female hero that didn't exist in much of British or Scottish folklore or much of mythology, and create that kind of character, and to do so specifically for the adolescent reader, and also to do it in a way that wasn't specifically targeted to girls. She had a lot of boy readers as well, still does. Mm-hmm. The book sort of doesn't scream that this is for girls. There is a value to having boys read about a female hero as well. Mm-hmm. And you really cannot accuse that book of not being ambitious or textured.
That sounds great. What's the title?
Fire and Hemlock. Let's switch to another book, which some people have accused of being YA in disguise. There was a piece in this week's Vanity Fair on the Goldfinch.
The piece is by Evgenia Peretz, and it's about the Goldfinch, Donna Tartt's novel, which has spent about 7 months on the bestseller list and won a Pulitzer. And she asks, you know, like, this book that has achieved this sort of success, yet apparently in certain what she calls inner sanctums of literary good taste.
Let's confess that we are not in the inner sanctum here.
We're not in the inner sanctum.
We speak as outsiders.
That people feel like this book is sort of masquerading as a literary novel. Is this not very well written? And that certain people feel like, you know, they're worried that if this book finds its ways into the hands of a reader, that the reader will be turned off from literary fiction altogether. So it's this sort of making some of the same arguments, right? So is this literature? Is this entertainment? And who decides? Who are the gatekeepers?
Right. And the inner sanctum, we should say, according to the piece, is the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, and the Paris Review.
Yeah.
And all of them did not like this book.
Yeah, and it seems like people at those institutions that she spoke to also for the piece, who didn't necessarily write about the book at the time, also didn't like it. And
they're also worried about it. And this is the thing that ties it to the YA thing. This has been a week of people worried about what other people are reading in a way that I find...
I'm sorry, you liked your book.
I think the anxiety in this piece is even stranger in a way, because it just seems, you know, Perrette says fairly early on that there have been a lot of examples throughout history books that are very successful that lots of people didn't like, or lots of critics didn't like. That over time, some of those books actually came to be regarded as classics pretty unanimously, and others were just that very common thing, which is a bestseller that gives a lot of people pleasure, but that more, I don't know whether you want to call it snobbish. I mean, I don't necessarily think snobbish is, I think, you know, snob.
Discerning.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's room for that, obviously, but I also don't see why a book, one particular book that does well that maybe isn't the most tightly or expertly written thing threatens all of literature. I mean, that's a fairly common story.
Yeah. We spend so much time being depressed and anxious and worried about all of the great literature out there that gets ignored, that doesn't catch on. So I think it's only fair that we get upset and anxious about the books that do succeed.
That's
Thanks
true.
So much.
Thanks,
Thank
Pamela.
You, Pamela.
Lenore Skenazy is here to talk about her review this week of two new parenting books, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting by Alfie Cohn, and Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked by Paul Raeburn. Lenore, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks, Pamela. Happy to be here.
So these are two very different books, but part of, you know, a huge genre slash, you know, section of the bookstore that both of us are familiar with. You've written a parenting book yourself and written a lot about this. Give us a snapshot of each of the books. Let's start with The Myth of the Spoiled Child.
Alfie Cohn's book is basically a screed against all the pundits who say that kids need to fail sometimes, need to go home without a trophy, need more grit. And the Paul Raeburn book, Do Fathers Matter, is saying, hey, what about us? We're dads. There are so many millions of books and studies and articles written about the role of moms and how they can help or hurt their kids, generally hurt. Please put us in the spin.
We wanted to be told how we hurt our children, too.
I think so. I think there's this national desire to whip ourselves with a cat of nine tails about how we have been either disappointing our children, stifling them, stunting them, ignoring them, helping them too much. We eat up so much about what we've been doing wrong that now dads get to be part of it.
All right. Let's go back to the first one. Mm-hmm. Often when we talk about these books, I find myself referring back to a great history by Ann Hulbert of Raising America that mm-hmm. looked at sort of waves of parenting advice and how it sort of, you know, goes in these cycles. I mean, this is sort of running counter to a lot of the current, at least, talk in schools about, you know, the importance of resilience, the importance of failure, the importance mm-hmm. of grit. And of course, that is in response to an earlier wave saying the opposite. This
right.
is saying, like, let's go back to that earlier kind of self-esteem wave. Is it not? Is this part of the kind of self-esteem?
He's definitely in favor of self-esteem. And when you just talk about kids not hating themselves or feeling terrible about themselves, I don't think anybody is ever against self-esteem. What he defends that a lot of more recent writers have written against is the idea that children need to be reassured all the time that they are good, and yet you can't praise them too much because he's also against praise. So when we talk about the history of parenting books going, you know, in one direction and then the other and then this one being countervailing, there's one way that this book is right smack in the middle of the stream, which is telling you that you're probably doing it wrong.
Well, we all know that.
Yeah, right.
What does Alfie Cohn suggest that we do?
That's a good question. There's a lot of things that he suggests. He suggests that, for instance, rather than exposing a child to disappointment, we role play a disappointing moment with them so that they can live through it without actually having to have it in real life. He says, he says, if we're interested in helping children to anticipate and deal with unpleasant experiences, and by that he means like losing at soccer and going home without a trophy, it makes sense to discuss the details with them and perhaps guide them through role-playing exercises. But why would we subject kids to those experiences? So he wants parents to be extremely involved, proactive, looking ahead, sensing when a kid might be upset, hurt, needy, intervening, and intensively explaining and talking and feeling with the child. And only that is sufficient for the kid to feel okay.
So he thinks that this whole idea that we've been over-catering to children, that we've been spoiling them, is not true, I'm assuming, with his title.
He thinks that we haven't been doing almost enough for our children in terms of letting them know that we love them unconditionally.
And what about the whole idea of the skinned knee?
He feels that
let's explain what the skinned knee is for those who aren't intimately familiar with parenting shorthand these
days.
Isn't
that amazing? I guess there must be three or four parents out there who aren't. Wendy Mogul wrote a book called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee that was great and explained the idea that we've been getting to the point where we so empathize and so worry about our kids that we don't want them to experience any pain ever, including a skinned knee. And she finds a blessing in the skinned knee in that when you skin your knee and you get back up again and you go back to playing, you realize, it's not such a big deal. I can get along. I'm self-sufficient. I'm self-reliant. This isn't going to keep me down. He actually goes, Mr. Cohen, actually goes and says that there are those who find the blessing of a skinned knee, and he finds no blessing in it. He sees the pain in a skinned knee, and he doesn't understand why parents would ever want to subject their kids to it. Frankly, nobody wants to subject their kids to it. Nobody is going around skinning their kid's knee.
Right.
I don't think, and if they are, that is wrong. But standing back or believing that your kid can get up from some pain and go forward without a whole lot of extra padding is something he doesn't endorse.
That book, The Blessings of a Skinned Knee, I seem to recall, was founded in Judaism. And it's interesting looking at the headlines this week when Eric Cantor's defeat in the primary, one of the things he talked about was
that
how
is his one skinned knee, boy.
Yes, but in his Jewish faith that failure is also an opportunity. And is that what she was talking about a little bit in that book as well, that sort of when you have a setback, that then that's an opportunity for growth or for change or to take a step back and kind of reapproach something for children?
I'm not going to speak for Wendy Mogul, but that's certainly what I believe. I sort of believe in something that Alfie Cohn says is wrong, which is the inoculation idea of defeat or failure. Nobody likes it. And I agree that if all you have in your life is failure and you come from a difficult circumstances, broken family, drugs, you live in a place that stinks of urine, those are hard failures to pick yourself up from because it's ubiquitous. But he seems to equate the skinned knee with growing up impoverished,
right,
or growing up beaten and beaten down. And there's a vast difference. I agree that there's something to be said for rolling with the punches.
Mm-hmm.
He believes that children shouldn't have to roll with the punches because the punches knock them down and keep them there.
Let's turn. I don't want to give short shrift to fathers. It is Father's Day coming up this weekend, of course. So let's talk a little bit about Paul Raeburn's book, Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. What is Raeburn? What does he set out to do with this book?
I think he sets out to put poor dads on the same trajectory that moms have been on for at least the last 20 years, probably more, which is being told the ways that they make or break a child.
That sounds like fun.
Well, there's a lot of great fun stuff in there. He does look at a lot of animal studies, and he talks about certain kind of mice that mm-hmm. cuddle, the men cuddle their babies just as much as the mommy mice. And he talks about frogs that are male frogs that take the baby tadpoles into their mouths. Okay.
Rayburn is a science journalist, we should say. So yes. He's looking at a lot of animal studies and sort of scientific journals and kind of distilling them, right, for a popular audience.
And the most important thing he's doing is that he's looking at studies of dads, because most books and most studies have looked at the mother's influence, everything from genetically to what words they say, to how they hold the child, to what they feed the child, to how they talk to the child.
Right.
All that has been so focused on moms that there were some studies done that he quotes. I don't have the quote in front of me, where it's like the mother picked up the child and did this and that, and then when it comes to the father, it said father interacted.
Right. Is it a function of what the media covers, or is it a function actually of the studies themselves? Is there not enough research about how fathers interact and affect their children?
I think there's far less research mm-hmm. on the way fathers interact with their children, but he certainly found a lot. So I think that what there is an abundance of is studies of every which way that a parent, whether a mom or a dad, influences a child's psychological makeup, their future spouses, how fat they are, whether they're good at school, whether they drop out, whether they like apples or don't like apples. I mean, the issue today is not a lack of studies.
Right.
The issue is there are so many studies, you can feel like whatever you're doing, there's a study that says you should be doing the opposite.
The book is full of research, as you pointed out. What were the most interesting sort of tidbits, nuggets of information that you came across while reading it?
Well, what I really liked was it's not a tidbit. It was sort of his overarching revelation, which is that dads stick around when they know that they're doing something that helps their family. So if they have a job and they know that they're bringing in an income, if they're a caregiver and they know that the child absolutely loves them and depends on them, if they are playing with the kid and they see that the kid plays differently with them than with the mom, they really have to feel like they're contributing. And that to me was almost a revelation, believe it or not, because that might explain why some dads don't stick around. If they really feel that they don't have anything to contribute, why would they be there? So to me, that was the most interesting bit. And then other than that, was just sort of reading about different animals and the behavior of them from their pheromones up to their cuddling techniques.
The pregnant seahorse.
You know, the pregnant seahorse shows up again in Dave Eggers' book, The Circle. There's a lot of seahorses in literature these days.
One last thing that I think is very current in the discussion over fatherhood is the stay-at-home dad, which we know the numbers are still small, but mm-hmm. they are growing. Does he talk about that in the book and sort of what we know about how stay-at-home dads raise their kids?
He talks about the way dads interact differently with their kids. There was a really cool study, actually, if you ask about studies, that looked at the ways dads and moms go to swimming lessons with their kids. And the mom stays right in front of the kid, like, come to me, come to me,
oh, yeah,
come
this
to
is
me,
fascinating.
It's going to be okay. And the dad is behind the kid, like, come on, kid, you can do it. You don't need me, just go forward. And I thought that was not only a really interesting, specific study, but a metaphor.
Yes.
Because I know that I am way more nervous around my kids than my husband is. And I know that my husband did play more goofy games and maybe even some more rough and tumbling. I have two boys. Certainly, I was never the horsey. What can I say?
Right.
So, and also,
it hurts to be the horsey.
It hurts to be the horsey when you're not a horse. Let's put it that way. So, the interesting thing to me about his book was just recognizing that there really is a difference in the way, in general, men and women relate to their kids, but it's both very valuable. And actually, I want to also state one thing that he made unequivocal, which is this is not to say that if you are raising a kid with one mom or two moms or three or four or five, doesn't mean that you have to have a dad in the house or even in the picture to raise a happy, safe, successful child. It just means that there's a different thing that dads do bring to the picture.
All right. Well, that's a happy Father's Day message for all then. Thank you so much, Lenore.
Thanks, Pamela.
The books, again, are Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked by Paul Rayburn and The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting by Alfie Cohn. Lenore Skenazy reviews them both this week in the book review. Thanks so much, Lenore.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
On the fiction side of things, there's quite a lot, actually. Almost half the list is new titles, so I'll just run those down. Starting at number 10, Lisa C. has a new novel called China Dolls. She writes often about the historical Chinese-American experience, of course, and that is what this novel is. Again, it's writing about Chinese nightclubs in California in the 30s and 40s. One interesting thing about Lisa C., though, is that she's herself only one-eighth Chinese. Her great-grandfather immigrated to America when he was 14 years old in 1871. But she grew up very close to that side of the family and doesn't look Chinese herself at all. She's got red hair and freckles. And so she told me that she writes these books as a way to kind of place herself, to try to figure out who she is. She doesn't look Chinese, but she feels very much a Chinese American.
And that novel is reviewed in this week's issue.
Yes, it is. So that book, China Dolls, new at number 10. Then at number 9, Mary Kay Andrews continues. It's not a series, but the thing that she does, she writes about Savannah, these kind of homey Savannah novels. This one's called Save the Date. It is about a wedding florist in Savannah trying to secure the gig at the big society wedding of the season. That's new at number 9. Mary Kay Andrews' real name is Kathy Hogan Trocheck. She's a former reporter who, under her real name, wrote a series of mysteries a ways back. But once she hit it big as Mary Kay Andrews, those mysteries, the Callahan series, was re-released under the name Mary Kay Andrews, writing as Kathy Hogan Trocheck. So really, it's Kathy Hogan Trocheck writing as Mary Kay Andrews, writing as Kathy Hogan Trocheck.
Try to keep track of that.
In the meantime, you can just read Save the Date, new at number 9. At number 8, Jeff Shara has the third book in a series about the Civil War called The Smoke at Dawn. That's new at number 8. Then at number 6, Alan First has another historical novel, historical spy military novel. This one's set in 1938. In between the world wars, just as World War II is about to get underway and the Spanish Civil War is already underway. This book is called Midnight in Europe, and it looks at a Spanish lawyer in Paris. And then at number 5, Laurel K. Hamilton continues her Meredith Gentry paranormal romance series. This is the 9th book in the series called A Shiver of Light, new at number 5. Then at number 3, Dorothea Benton Frank, also not continuing a series, but continuing what she does. She writes books set in the South Carolina Low Country, and the latest one is called The Hurricane Sisters. That's new at number 3.
And then no stranger to the bestseller list.
Also not continuing a series, a standalone thriller from Mr. Stephen King, new at number 1, a thriller called Mr. Mercedes, about a retired cop trying to track down the man who mowed down a bunch of people at a job fair in a stolen Mercedes.
And reviewed a couple of weeks ago in our pages.
That's right, by Megan Abbott.
Nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there are just 2 new titles. At number 12, John Waters has a book called Karsak. He, of course, is the cult movie director. He directed Hairspray and a bunch of other beloved cult hits. He set out to hitchhike from Baltimore. He's a great old Baltimore figure. He set out to hitchhike from Baltimore to California. So sort of as a gimmick, with an idea to write a book about it. He wrote that book now. It's called Karsak. It's new at number 12.
It was also reviewed in our summer reading.
And then the only other new title on the nonfiction hardcover list this week is new at number 9. It's by the Fox News anchor Brett Baer, co-written with Jim Mills. It's called Special Heart, and it is a memoir looking at his 6-year-old son, Paul, who was born with heart disease. His son had to go through 3 open heart surgeries, the first of them when he was only 12 days old. He's mm-hmm. also had 7 angioplasties. And so it's really a family memoir, a memoir of how Bear and his wife Amy have drawn closer and what their relationship is like with their son going through this challenge together.
Well, it feels appropriate for Father's Day.
Very much a Father's Day book.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.